This is Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast.
In this episode of Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast, we have an interview with Chris Crawford, author of Eastern Front 1941. We rescue Atari hardware and TI-99 hardware. We find a new source for reliable Atari power supplies. And we take a look at an Atari emulator that works in your web browser. Let's go! Hello there! Welcome to another adrenaline-packed episode of Antic, the Atari podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to talk about the vintage Atari 8-bit line of computers. We're going to cover news, talk about history, present interviews, discuss the various Atari 8-bit computers and their capabilities, and even delve into the occasional technical topic. We want this to be fun for everyone. Even if your favorite computer is the Tandy Coco or the PC Junior, we want you to be able to learn something about Atari computers and why they hold a special place in all of our hearts. This is episode 4, and I'll be your host. I'm Randy Kindig, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Brad Arnold and Kevin Savitz.
Hello.
Hey, Kevin.
Hey.
What have you been up to?
What have I been up to? Let's see. This is the first episode we've recorded since summer vacation, and I went out to Phoenix, Arizona to visit my mom. And when I was out there, we went to the Phoenix Art Museum, and they were having the Art of Video Games exhibit, which was a lot of fun.
That sounds interesting.
It was interesting. There were video games. You could play video games, and there were screenshots from games, and it kind of showed the timeline of video games evolutions from very simple graphics to more modern games, and kind of how they changed along the way from the 8-bit era to the 16-bit era, and so on.
Did you recognize a lot of the art?
I recognized most everything there. Anybody of a certain age who's been playing games for the last 30 years would recognize things. I mean, there was 2600 games and television. I didn't see any specifically Atari 8-bit stuff there. There was stuff there for you know, Genesis and different Sega games up to modern games, PlayStation 3 and that sort of thing. I thought it was interesting, though, there was some games you could play, and there was a giant Pac-Man game, the original arcade version of Pac-Man, on a giant projection screen, and you walk up and you press the button, say, I want to play Pac-Man, and instructions came on the screen, like, explaining, you have to move the man and try to eat the dots and avoid, I'm just like, really? I mean, I understand. I really understand that a museum needs to provide context, but explaining Pac-Man, I don't know. It just seemed a little strange that someone should go to a video game exhibit and not even know Pac-Man.
So is this just a temporary exhibit?
It's a temporary exhibit. It's running through September 29th, and I think it's a traveling thing that you might be able to see other places.
I'm sorry I'm going to miss it.
It was a lot of fun. Let's see what else. There's a Commodore Computer Club just outside of Portland, and since there's no Atari group that I'm aware of, I slum it and hang out with the Commodore people once in a while. And so I took my Atari 800XL and went to the Commodore group and hung out with some nice people, and we played some games, played with some Atari cartridges and some Commodore games, and that was good. And I guess my big news is I've announced a couple of new book projects. Basically, I went to Atari Age and threw out there, because I need some help, ask some questions, and I announced some book projects that I'm working on that I'll mention here. One is Atari specific. I'm going to do a book that is sort of the best of Antic magazine. I talked to Jim Caparel about this when I was doing the interview last month, and we're going to kind of choose articles from Antic magazine that are still that are relevant to a modern audience from a historical perspective. And so I kind of need some help from people choosing the articles that ran in Antic that will be interesting to people in 2013. So that's number one. And number two is I've started work on a book about the first computer magazines. This isn't an Atari-specific project, but it's going to be about Creative Computing Magazine and Byte and Kilobaud Microcomputing. Those were, as I believe, the first three personal computer magazines to be published. And I've started writing the book, and it's exciting. I got to interview, I've interviewed Dave Ahl of Creative Computing Magazine. I interviewed Wayne Green of Kilobaud, and he just died.
Yeah.
So it was sad to hear that he died, but I felt very lucky that I managed to interview him just a couple of months before he passed away. And I'm going to interview Carl Helmers, who was the first editor of Byte. So what I'm looking for there is if people have memories of those magazines, either as a reader or a writer or a subscriber or just have feelings about those magazines, I'd really like to hear from you for possible inclusion in the book. So those are my current what I've been up to.
Wow, that's exciting. I can't wait to see what comes out of it. How do you find all the time to do these book projects, Kevin?
I just do a little bit at a time. With a Terrible Nerd, my goal was to write 600 words a day, and it's easy to write 600 words a day. It's hard to write a whole book, but if you just think of it as tiny little chunks, then it's not so bad.
Interesting. I've got a couple ideas myself I'd like to do sometime, but it just seems like a lot of work. Brad, what have you been up to?
Not a whole lot. I've scrapped my SIO 2PC laptop project. I realized I was spending more time fighting with the old laptop I was trying to use than actually using it. So I'm going to rebuild it with a slightly newer machine. And other than that, unfortunately, there's been almost no retro computing lately. My real-life job has been keeping me very busy. About the only thing I have done retro computing is not even Atari-related. I recently rescued a box of TI-99 4A stuff off of a local Google programmer who was going to Peru to learn Spanish.
Wow.
And I guess it's one place to learn Spanish. But I have new to me box of TI-99 stuff sitting in my living room. Now it's all right.
Is it the complete set of stuff? It doesn't include the big PEB box that has capability putting in the cards and all that? No? Okay.
Yeah. I actually have one of those. I have a TI-99 collection that I've gotten because no one else collected it, and I just kind of ended up with this stuff, and I actually have a decent, the beginnings of a decent TI-99 collection. I guess one of these days I have to put some quality time into it and set it up and learn it. But
you should use it to learn Spanish, just to show that Peru guy that he didn't need to go.
That's a thought. That's a thought. And Randy, what have you been up to?
Well, I'm glad that you asked. I am getting ready to go to VCF Midwest September 28th and 29th. I'm not sure. We should have the show out before then, so hopefully you'll hear that. If not, we'll talk about it a little bit on the next show, but it's in Lombard, Illinois. I am planning to have a table there and some sort of display for the Antic and Floppy Days podcast. I also have some interviews lined up. I contacted the Suburban Chicago Atarians, which is also known as SCAT, which is a user group based around Chicago, obviously, which if that happens as planned, then maybe it will appear in a future Antic episode. Pretty excited about that, trying to get everything ready. I'm trying to get the display finished, and my wife is helping me with that. And, I'm trying to prepare for the interviews as well. Looking forward to it. Should be a lot of fun.
Cool.
I'm also working on a Floppy Days podcast on the TRS-80 Model 1. I am saving money for an Atari SD or Compact Flash interface. I don't know if you guys, either one of you guys have a SD or Compact Flash interface for the Atari?
I have the card. I think it's called Atari Max 2. It's really cool. It's complicated. Setting it up is a little trickier than I had anticipated. So I haven't really delved into figuring it out. Instead, I use my SIO2SD card, which emulates, makes the Atari think that a SD card is a floppy drive. And that's the thing I tend to use more often because it's more intuitive to me.
Is that the one from Lotharek, or however you pronounce his name?
There's the design for how to do it is just out there. But yeah, there's a guy, I think it's Lotharek, who sells them.
Okay. Well, I've decided that rather than continuing to acquire more computers, I would spend my money actually trying to improve the ones I have, you know, mm-hmm. beef them up a little bit. So I have the SIO to PC, the USB version for the Atari, but I don't have any SD or compact flash interface. So I'm saving my pennies to buy something.
That's a good way to go. It really changes the way you use the Atari.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, for Atari-based, I just purchased a bunch of Atari equipment off of Craigslist. And as I look back, I'm not sure why I did this. I don't know if I was thinking I could rescue these or what, but this gentleman had an Atari 800, 130XE, three 1050 drives, a 1025 and 1027 printer, 410 cassette recorder, power supplies for all of these, tapes, floppies, and he only wanted $50 for all of it.
Oh, that's a steal.
Awesome.
And I thought for that, you know, I would pick it up, and there are a couple of those things I don't have. I don't have a 130XE. I have a 1027 printer, but I don't have the power supply for it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the power supply for that. So I thought I could, you know, pick a few of the items and keep, and then clean up the rest of it and sell it. Turns out it's going to need a lot of cleaning. It was not in a smoke-free home, and it was not kept clean, so I have a lot of work ahead of me. So, again, I'm not sure exactly why I did this, but I've got a bunch of work ahead of me.
Fun.
So that's it. That's basically what I've been up to. Okay, let's move into the news. Kevin, I believe you had the first item here?
Yeah, the first item is Chris Crawford, who is the author of Eastern Front 1941, recently released the source code for Eastern Front on his website, and there will be a link to that in the show notes at ataripodcast.com. So this isn't the first time he released the source code. Actually, back in the day, you could buy the source code for something like $150 from Atari Program Exchange, but the source code that he's released now can be read on your PC, and he's got full annotation and lots of comments, as well as lots of other interesting things, articles and pictures, and you can see the unfinished follow-up game, Western Front 1943.
Really?
Yeah. That's in the package, too. So there's a lot of interesting stuff there. If you're interested in Eastern Front and early Atari war games, it's definitely worth checking out.
What's this written in? C? Assembler?
He wrote it in Assembler.
Kevin, just late last week, he has released the source code for a game he did called Excalibur.
Really? I did not know that yet.
Yep, just released it. So so he's continuing to release his source codes.
Cool. Well, I interviewed Chris earlier, I guess last week, and that'll be later on in this podcast. But when I had talked to him, he said that we're still working on Excalibur. It's good to know that they're making progress on that. He intends to release source code for more of his Atari games as he can.
That's very interesting. I definitely would like to take a look at this because I know he did some really good programming, and definitely something you could learn from.
Absolutely. And Eastern Front was really one of the among the best-selling Atari games, and right. I'm sure there's all sorts of interesting things to learn from it.
Yeah, it's a fun game. It's been about a month or so ago, but I pulled it out and actually played around. And I like computer war games. So, I still like playing that game.
Okay, this next item is a follow-up item to something that we talked about in a previous episode, and that has to do with the continuing saga of the Atari bankruptcy. As we mentioned, the U.S. divisions of Atari are in Chapter 11, and the parent company, Atari S.A., is not covered by U.S. jurisdiction and is outside the Chapter 11 proceedings. And they're plodding along, but they also are saddled by huge debt. It turns out the U.S. division slashed their employee count to just two people after the Atari assets began to sell. And the key assets, including the Atari brand itself and the classic properties, were pulled from the auction process. And this happened because the debtors have spent the last 4 weeks working with Atari SA and their lender to negotiate a plan of reorganization to acquire the debtors' remaining assets, the debtors being the U.S. division. So the official committee that represents Atari's unsecured creditors believe Atari has spent too much time already coming up with such a plan and shouldn't be allowed any further period of exclusivity to try to work out an insider-sponsored solution. So it sounds like it will continue to go on, and we'll keep an eye on this and let you know if we hear anything else.
Soap opera continues.
It's like watching a train wreck. It's sad. Yeah.
In slow motion. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kevin, I believe you had the next item.
Yeah, the next item is JS Mess now emulates the Atari 800 in a browser. Now, my friend Jason Scott, everyone's favorite nerdy person, Jason Scott, has been spearheading a project called JS Mess. Now, which means JavaScript Mess, and Mess is the emulator, the multi-emulator super system, I think.
So it doesn't mean Jason Scott's Mess?
It does not. It means JavaScript.
Oh. Okay.
So Mess is an emulator program that emulates a bunch of different computers and video game systems. And this effort he's been spearheading has been to convert it to JavaScript so that it can run in a browser. And he's been working on this for some time with a team of programmers. And they've finally gotten to emulate the Atari 800. So you can go to the link, in which will be in the show notes at ataripodcast.com, and sure enough, you can run a Atari 800 emulator in your browser. Now, it's not perfect yet. I haven't never gotten the sound to work, and the keyboard is kind of flinky. It's not perfect, but it's a proof of concept, and it's going to allow you to run arbitrary software right there without having to install an emulator or have an Atari or whatever. And I think that the goal is, I think Jason's vision of this is, you might be able to read an article about a particular game. Maybe you're reading about Star Raiders, and you could click a link and see and play the game immediately with absolutely no barrier. Really going to be able to bring historical computing to the masses right there in the web.
That's amazing. That's amazing that JavaScript has come far enough that you could do something like this in JavaScript.
It is amazing. And also, I don't want to underplay the other, this is an Atari podcast, so I wanted to roll with that, but it also, they have JS Mess doing something like 100 other computer systems, Apple II and Commodore and a lot of other systems too. So it's worth checking out. It's not perfect yet. Don't expect to be able to play Mule quite yet, but you can, soon. I think it's really coming along, and I'll follow up in a future podcast as it gets better.
Interesting. Does it require a specific browser?
Yes. I don't think it likes Safari. I think it does like Chrome and Firefox.
Okay.
It depends on the JavaScript implementation. As I understand, it does not work on the iPad, but it does work on certain other mobile devices.
I'll have to check that out.
Too bad it didn't work on the iPad. That would be a great way to play your Atari game on your iPad.
Yeah, it would. And it doesn't work on the iPad today. Maybe in the future.
Yeah.
Okay, the next item is the 4 megabyte flash megacart. That's a mouthful. It's basically a 16 kilobyte cartridge that has 255 banks that are software selectable. I understand this is fairly new. There was a discussion about this on Atari Age, and there's a YouTube video that you can see more about this, which we'll have links to in the show notes. This cartridge has several uses, such as backing up and restoring files, writing floppy disk to, and then booting from it, or you can just load up a huge amount of games in its flash memory. There's also a free program suite available in Java, which runs directly from any PC, and it allows you to then choose any software that you like and make an ATR file and flash it to your MegaCart so that you can then run a menu-based system that has all of your favorite software on it. So the cost for this is 46 euro, which I believe isn't the exchange rate, something like 1.5.
Yeah, so that would be what, about $70 or so?
Yeah, somewhere around $70, including shipping and handling to anywhere in the world. And the guy on Atari Age, his handle is Moonsweeper, had a limited number that he was selling, but there were supposed to be more available from the developer soon. Cool. So definitely would be something worth checking out. Brad?
Here's a quick one. This is a follow-up to our second episode where we were talking about the annual Atari party that took place in July. What was it, July 6th in Davis, California? And they've posted some pictures from the Fresno Commodore Group FCUG. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. And
you could get yourself in trouble if you try to pronounce it.
Yeah.
This is a clean podcast.
All right. This next item is something that I came across on eBay, or again, I think I originally came across a discussion perhaps on Atari Age and then saw it on eBay. It's a USB-based power adapter cable that can be used to power some of the Atari 8-bit computers, such as the 600XL, 800XL. Doesn't work with the 400 and 800, but it's USB-based. You can plug it into a USB power adapter. Now, a USB port on a computer apparently doesn't generate enough power to power your Atari computer. But if you've got a USB-based power adapter like I do for my iPad, you could use that to, so it's got the Atari connector on the other end, and you can plug it into your Atari computer to power it. And with it, you know, with power supplies becoming more and more scarce as they start to go out, this is, you know, possibly a reasonable option for continuing to power your computers.
I was really intrigued by this when I saw it in our production show notes, and I emailed the guy who's selling these cables. Apparently he makes them himself, and I asked him about the power filtering on the cables and if he sells versions for the Atari 400, and here's what he told me. He said his name is GDO Inventor, Inventer is his eBay name. He says, I've assembled and sold power supplies for Ataris that require the DIN7 plug for about 3 years, and most likely will not sell any other type, meaning he doesn't intend to make cables for the Atari 400 and 800 machines. I custom modify the plugs from the best DIN7 plugs I can find and use surplus modern 5-volt power supplies that were intended for technology equipment, therefore they are filtered. I have not had a failure of my power supplies and have had no reports of damage to Atari computers. He said the USB cable that you found, it was a new product that seems to have good interest, and I tested the product for about 3 months before release. I'm looking into having the USB cable produced by other parties for a larger marketing effort. So yeah, this is a new thing that you found, and you plug it into the Atari at one point and the USB adapter for your iPad on the other end and power, and you don't have to deal with fussy old Atari power supplies. I also found one. He had one which doesn't have the USB. It just goes to a regular two or three prong outlet to plug it in. So that way you don't have to find a USB adapter. You could just, it's just pretty much a turnkey replacement. For Atari power supplies.
Without being as bulky and heavy as the Atari ones are.
Right, right. Oh, no, just, I also wanted to mention that your news item reminded me of an Atari Age post I had seen some time ago. Someone posted a picture of all the different Atari power supplies with notes about which ones are reliable, which ones you shouldn't trust for long-term use, and which ones work on which machines. And so if you are using a real Atari power supply, I mean, it seems like there's certain ones that, at least according to this fellow, you want to avoid, or if they die, they might take your computer with it, and which is a problem I've definitely had over the years. So there's a link to that in the show notes too.
Okay. Kevin, I think you had the next one.
I do. A couple episodes ago, we mentioned GTIA Blast, which is a demo and might eventually turn into a game that does some impressive things with the GTIA chip. We mentioned this back in episode 2. I just wanted to throw out there that they added a couple of new versions of the demo. One uses GTIA mode 11, and in this mode, black and 15 colors are available, but all with the same Luma. So it really vibrant, bright colors. Looks really cool. And the other one is uses GTIA mode 10, which means 9 colors are available, but some of them are shared with the player missile graphics. So it's kind of a trade-off. But they're both really interesting demos, and there's little spaceships flying around and against interesting, colorful backgrounds. And this is going to turn into a neat thing eventually. It's neat to see them progress as they advance on these demos.
Yeah, I did look at this demo, and it's pretty nice. I was impressed.
So next up, the Atari Bitbiter user group in Germany is having an Atari programming contest. And unfortunately, it seems like the entry deadline has passed, and yet they haven't announced the winners yet. So we're right now, as we're recording this, we're kind of in a weird time where there's not really news, but they have this contest with a cash prize for the best new Atari program. And people have been, I think 12 or 15 people have submitted programs, mostly games, but not entirely. And they're going to very soon announce the winners. And hopefully, I believe, the people who enter the contest will actually release the programs so that we can all play it and see them. Anyway, so I'm excited to play these games and find out who the winners are. And it's exciting that there's still people having contests for creating new Atari programs.
You see this all the time for some of the other platforms, particularly the Commodore and the Coco. Mm-hmm. So I definitely would like to see more of this on the Atari side. Brad, I think you got next.
The Verge has an interesting article on how Atari box art turned 8-bit games into virtual wonderlands. Well, it's a bit of hyperbole to me, but it's a kind of a cool little article on some Atari box art and cartridge art, and very much worth a quick perusal, because there's some nice pics of some of the art, because in those games, you know, putting a screenshot of Pong on your box is
not going to sell a lot of copies of Pong.
Not going to sell a lot. So the Atari graphics department was really good at coming up with visualizations of the world they wanted to, you know, to try to pull you into. It's a nice little read. Links in the show notes.
And finally, new Atari book scans at archive.org. I'd like to check out and see what's new there. Dozens of new Atari books have been added in the past weeks. If you want to read old books about Atari 8-bit computers, go to archive.org/details/Atari books. For programmers, new stuff includes Atari Pilot for Beginners, Atari Roots, and maybe the best title ever for an Atari book, Dr. Wacko's Guide to Creating Arcade Games. For techies, Inside Atari DOS and the Master Memory Map. And just for people who like interesting stuff, The Book of Atari Software 1984, which was just a catalog of software with screenshots and descriptions of hundreds of pieces of software, and The Blue Book, which is I think we've discussed before.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. There are a couple titles there I would like to own in my library.
Well, until that day comes, you can read them online.
Yeah. Exactly.
And actually, I think Dr. Wacko's was a series, if I remember correctly.
I think it was, yeah.
I wish there was a way we could easily convert these to ebook formats.
Mm-hmm.
PDFs just don't read well on a iPad or something. Because you can't do annotations or stuff like that with them.
Right.
Well, that's true. I'm going to say they read fairly well in the Kindle app, or I'm sorry, in the iBooks app on the iPad. But you're right. You can't do some of the same things you can do with an ebook.
And see, that's what I would like to be able to do with, you know, if one of the programming books, if I was reading through, I'd like to highlight, not, you know, underline and do all that stuff. But maybe in the future.
Okay, this next section is a new section to really talk about some tips. So this may not be brand new news, but there are some useful sites and hardware, software, etc. that we thought we might be able to bring to you. First one I wanted to talk about here briefly is the Atari User Magazine, which bills itself as the world's only monthly Atari magazine. It covers not just the 8-bit computers, it covers all the Atari consoles, but it does cover the 8-bit machines as well. It has coverage of all the latest Atari news, including homebrew hardware modifications, new game releases, interviews with Atari greats such as Nolan Bushnell, Ted Dabney, and Doug Neubauer, features on rare or unreleased Atari titles, programming, hardware reviews, and many other things. I have purchased a couple of these in the PDF format, and that is one of the ways it is available. You can purchase it. It is monthly, and readers get direct download links to the public domain shareware and homebrew releases featured in the magazine. The digital edition is available for $4.25. And the print edition is actually, you can get a print edition in full color from MagCloud, which is not a service that I'm familiar with, for $15.95. And you can get a black and white print edition with a full color cover from Lulu for $12.74. So, you know, it's definitely something worth checking out. Have either one of you purchased any of these magazines? Have you read this?
No, I haven't read it before, but I'm going to spend the $4 and get the digital version right away.
Yeah, like I said, I bought a couple of months worth. This was several months ago, and I've not kept up with it, but I felt like it was really good what I read so far.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out.
Brad, I think the next tip was from you.
Yes, there's a website out there called Starring the Computer. And this website tries to catalog TV and movie appearances by computers. And they're rated by importance, in other words, how important the computer is to the plot, realism, how close it is in its appearance and capabilities are to the real thing, and visibility. In other words, is it, you know, is it way off into the background, or is it, you know, up in front? And for this website, the fictional computers don't count, so Colossus will not be in there. But a couple of ones for Ataris. Let's see, we have the Atari 1200 XL was shown up in WizKids episode 9. You remember that, don't
you? I remember when that episode came out, how excited I was because there was an Atari on the TV. Yeah.
Yes. And then a movie called Red Star Rising, which I fortunately think I've missed, although I think I've heard of it.
I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah. See, the Atari 400 has shown up in Microman. And then Magna PI Season 4, Episode 3. There's many, many more. I just don't want to sit here and read off. You know, check it out and see where the Ataris have shown up.
So the next tip that I had was BNC Computer Vision, which is Atari Sales and Service at myatari.com. And this is a site that has lots and lots of Atari hardware, accessories, software, cables, etc. And it looks like it's still active. I haven't bought anything from them for a very long time. How about you guys? Have you ordered anything from BNC Computer Vision?
I think I have, but it's been quite a while. I still follow them on eBay. I believe they are MyAtari on eBay, and they're still posting stuff all the time. A lot of the same stuff again and again, cases and power supplies and floppy disks and that sort of thing. But it's really good to know there's still a kind of semi-official Atari seller and service company out there.
Yeah, anything that you need, at least you know that you can go there. And their prices are not necessarily better than you might find on eBay, but I think you do have one place you can go to and get a lot of that stuff. So that's nice. It's unusual this day and age to still have somebody selling that stuff. Okay, we're going to move into the listener feedback section now. We've had quite a few notes and emails, and
I love getting listener feedback.
Yeah, and we've gotten lots of it. So, Kevin, you want to talk about the first one?
Sure. We got some comments on the interview I did with Jim Caparel in episode 3 on Atari Age. Fletch wrote, "Listening to James Caparel talk about the magazine was kind of sad. He seemed full of regret about many things and focused quite a bit on his personal failings. I, for one, remember Antic, Start, and even Mac Home Journal fondly. Hopefully, he realizes there is more to success than money."
I can agree with that. To me, Antic, it's like that was one of the two only really good magazines for the Atari 800. Mm-hmm. West of House replied, "That was a dynamite interview with Caparel. To me, it seemed more wistful than somber. I'm not sure that's regret we're hearing or simply a deep nostalgia for that wonderful time, which I share. His quote about those Atari days is spot on. A time that's only yesterday, but long gone, never to be repeated."
So we also got one from ATX4S. "The podcasts are fantastic. The interview with Jim Caparel of Antic was great. I hope that you can have a chance to interview Tom Hudson of Analog Magazine." Sounds like a great idea. "His games got me and many others here, I'm sure, interested in programming on the Atari computers. Please keep these coming." We also had some great comments on LinkedIn. There is a Atari Legacy group on LinkedIn that I joined. I don't know if you guys are a member of this or not. But,
No, I didn't know about this.
Yeah, there's an Atari Legacy group. There's also a general vintage computing group as well that has some interesting information on it. So we got some good comments there. Kevin, you want to talk about the first one?
Ludo said, "It has been many years, in fact, almost 20, I reckon, since my first introduction to computing. My first Atari was an 800XL with this tape unit that I will never forget." A lot of us will never forget those tape units. "Those were the days, 45 minutes loading pole position. I will subscribe to your podcast, and all my years in IT, I look back to that time with great fondness. Thanks for the initiative." Thank you, Ludo.
And Justin said, "Enjoyed the second podcast with the book recommendations and discussion. Also, the web links from all three broadcasts were very useful."
And finally, we had a comment on the AtariPodcast.com website.
I didn't know you could leave comments on the website.
Yep, we've got a comment section, and you can. I think there's a link actually under each show that you can click on if you want to leave a comment. And this is from someone named Kevin. He says, "I am inspired. Setting up my 130XE. So far, I've had transkey problems, and a power supply has a 60 hertz hum, and my video cable needed repaired. Please keep the podcast coming." And now, a blast from the past.
Atari brings the computer age home.
Gonna run, gonna go!
Late again, huh, Dad?
With an Atari home computer.
Have a nice day at the office.
You can easily work at home or open your home to a world of possibilities. In fact, the hardest part about owning an Atari home computer isn't how to use it, but who gets to use it.
I'll get clothes, Dad. Mind if I do my work?
Hey, no problem.
Atari Home Computers, we brought the computer age home.
So for this episode's feature topic, I interviewed Chris Crawford. Chris Crawford is the author of Eastern Front 1941, which was one of the most popular best-selling Atari games. It started off as a game for Atari Program Exchange and eventually became so popular that Atari pulled it in and made an actual Atari cartridge out of it that was sold through retail channels. Chris Crawford is also one of the authors of Day Ray Atari, which is, I think we all agree, one of the best books about programming the Atari. And he programmed a bunch of other stuff, which we'll talk about in the interview. And it was exciting to get to talk to Chris for a little while. Now, this is the interview that I'm about to play is about 25 minutes. If you want to hear the full interview, it goes over an hour. I'm going to put that up at archive.org. There will be a link to that in the show notes at ataripodcast.com. But rest assured, this is the most interesting good stuff that we could fit into 25 minutes. Here it is. I'm going to start with the question I usually end with. What are you most proud of in your career as a game designer?
Cebu. A game called Trust and Betrayal that I did for the Macintosh. It was way ahead of its time. It was weird. We published it in 1987. And you had conversations with other characters in this mental ESP kind of language. And you had genuine interpersonal interactions with these people. They could get mad. You could sweet talk them. I mean, they really did behave like characters. They were primitive, but they were way, way ahead of anything that has been done before or since. There's still nothing as sophisticated as that game. Balance of Power was probably my second big achievement, largely because of its big sales. Mm-hmm. It affected a lot of people, taught a lot of people about geopolitics, and that was good. So, and then third would be Eastern Front for the Atari.
So. Why are you so interested in geopolitics and war games and what? Is that your thing?
I was a child of Vietnam. My whole generation faced that, and we were all very worried about that. And whereas most other people took the approach of fight the evil, I wanted to understand it. My feeling was, it was the quintessential rationalist thinking, well, if we can only figure out what's really going on here, we can find a solution. Well, that's naive, but I was a student. Mm-hmm. And so I set out trying to understand war. And I spent a long time studying military history, if only because military history itself is very interesting, just the logic of it and the way things actually get done and how they fail. And from there, I moved on to the question of how do you avoid getting into a war in the first place? And I did lots of reading about that, and those ideas gelled together for me with Balance of Power. But I was first experimenting with them with Eastern Front. I did a whole bunch of war games, in each of which I tried to focus on some element of war that is not immediately obvious. And in effect, I was trying to teach what makes war tick.
Can you give an example?
In Eastern Front, the two big ideas there that people don't appreciate are, first, the importance of surrounding an enemy unit, cutting them off, not just from supplies, but from their natural retreat, and that causes them to panic. And that connected directly with the second point, which is that military organizations operate only when there's a strong sense of social cohesion, when everybody believes together that this will work. And there's always a point in combat where that breaks and a military unit becomes a mob. And that was an important part of Eastern Front, where you had muster strength and combat strength. Muster strength is how many men you have. Combat strength is how many men are willing to fight. And as they get into combat, you're not just killing people, you're rattling them. And they rattle a lot faster than they die. And so if you just keep hitting them, at a certain point, they'll break and run. And that was one of the main points of Eastern Front.
I just read an article you wrote about for Creative Computing way back in the day about a narrative history of Eastern Front and how you went about creating the game. And I was surprised to learn that it started off as a game for the Commodore PET. Called, I don't know how to say it, Aurora Podiba?
Ura Pobaida.
I knew you'd say it better than I could.
Hooray for the motherland! That was one of the Russian war cries. And fortunately, Dale Yoakum at Atari had the good sense to talk me out of using an unpronounceable title and suggested I use something a little more obvious. Mm-hmm. So I tend to do that, use these obscure things that nobody understands.
And then you said you had 317 versions of Eastern Front before it was done.
Yeah. Basically, every time I made a change or whatever, I'd save it as the next version. And that's how many builds I went through.
Wow. And then, I guess, after it was published by APX and then it later became a real Atari cartridge, you made it even harder at that point?
Yeah.
Some of the other changes that happened there?
Well, the main thing was I felt that Eastern Front was too easy to beat, the first edition. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'd gotten letters from people saying, oh yeah, I wiped out the Russians. And so I wanted to make sure that there was a level that nobody could beat. Mm-hmm. And so I put in that. But I also added some sophistication to the game, extra doodads and gewgaws. I tightened up the artificial intelligence a little bit. You know, it was no big change. It was just an improvement. Mm-hmm. Now, most games follow that path. They have their starting version, and then they go through version 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and so forth. And I have no patience for that. There are too many games. There are too many other games to do to waste time just souping up an old design.
Sure. I know it was APX's number one program for a long time. And then you came out with ancillary stuff. You released the source code.
Yeah.
Which I think was highly unusual.
Yeah.
And you released the scenario editor, which I kind of get the impression was just like a tool that you use maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, it was something I already had. Basically, Dale Yoakum at APX was really eager for anything Eastern Front. And so I decided, well, let's release the source code. Now, it took me a lot of time. It wasn't just a matter of, okay, here's the source code, publish it. I had to write up detailed explanations of everything about how it worked. This was important because I wanted to, you know, other people to be able to learn from it. And so I spent months just getting all of that ready to go. And then the scenario editor was something that I had built for my own purposes, and it just took a little tidying up to ship it. Hmm. Actually, one of the surprising things was that Dale Yoakum set the price for the source code. God, I think it was $150.
Wow.
I was astounded that he wanted that much, but he said, you know, that was his decision to make.
Interesting.
He knows the ground better than I do. So.
And then you released the source code again just recently on your website.
Yeah.
And I went to download it, and I was very pleasantly surprised to see that it's not just the source code. I mean, you threw in everything you could find. There's it's annotated, and you describe, you know, there's articles in there. You put in Western Front, which is, I guess, an unfinished follow-up game.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
I think I started working on Western Front after I was laid off from Atari. I thought, I need a little money. Let me try this. And so I put it together. I was not pleased with the way it was coming out. And so I set that aside. You know, maybe I'll come back to it someday. I then went on to work on another game that I think was much more interesting called Last of the Incas. And we'll be releasing that as soon as I can get that cleaned up. But that was a much more interesting design. It involved what's called in physics Galilean relativity.
Okay.
It's the idea that you don't know about something until the message from it reaches you. And so in this game, you're the Spanish, and the Inca army is moving around up in the mountains, but in the mountains, news travels very slowly. And so you don't find out about where they've attacked until a messenger from that area can reach you. And so if you set off towards them, they might be long gone by the time you get there. And so I developed this concept, and it turned out to be a very interesting idea, and I was rather pleased with it. But by that time, the market for Atari games had collapsed. There were no publishers interested.
How does it make you feel that today, though, people are still interested in the source code to that and all your other stuff, really?
I'm surprised, mostly. I can understand, you know, the appeal of it. It's rather like working on an old Volkswagen. It's a simple, clean engine. You can really get in there and work at it at the fundamental level, whereas modern cars you don't dare touch. So I can see the appeal of that. But for the kind of things that I want to do, the Atari is way too lacking in resource. I mean, modern machines are, I do not exaggerate, billions of times more powerful. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of hard to ignore.
So what do you want to do? What are you doing today?
I'm working on interactive storytelling. That's been my big project for 20 years now. Although actually it started back at Atari when I went to work for Alan Kay. He was a real inspiration. He challenged me to think big, you know, what's really important. And I remember spending a lot of time just going on long walks, meditating, and I finally decided that the fundamental challenge in game design could be summarized in the slogan, "People, not things." The idea being that games should be about people. Movies are not about things. Movies are about people. But in games, it's always things. You know, you're chasing things, shooting things, acquiring things, gobbling things, but there are never any real people. And so I decided back at Atari Research that I had to work on the problem of people. That's why I did Gossip and then Excalibur. And I continued screwing around with that concept until about 20 years ago when I decided, all right, look, I got to commit myself to this. And it has turned out to be an immensely difficult problem. In 20 years, I have not yet solved it. But I can take some consolation in the fact that when I started, nobody else was interested in it. And in fact, games people were all saying, "Stories? Are you out of your head, Crawford? What we need is 3D graphics." And in the last 10 years or so, suddenly storytelling has grown more and more important in the eyes of the community. And in fact, now there's lots of people working on it, and they are years behind me because I had about a 10-year head start on them. So I'm now working on something. I'm actually redoing Seaboot on a much grander scale, and I went back to the basics, and I redesigned this thing from the ground up.
And C-Boot is the ESP communication game?
Yep. Yep. And I'm very pleased. It'll take me at least another year, but I'm pleased with the progress I'm making.
Excellent. Excellent. And you think that'll eventually be released commercially or Kickstarter?
Yeah.
Or
yeah. Yeah, I intend to do some sort of commercial release. I'm not sure exactly how I will do that. I know that I have to get it pretty far along before anybody will believe in it enough to contribute. But I'm working on it, and like I say, it'll be at least a year, possibly longer, but I'm going to get it done. This is my major project now. And so I'm working on the deep down guts calculations, and they're working pretty well already. I've got characters engaging in conversations where they gossip about each other. They can propose deals, negotiate deals. I'm just now bringing up the feature where they can lie to each other.
So your characters in the game actually talk to each other and work autonomously?
Oh, yeah.
So they don't know what the other ones are going to do ahead of time?
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, and they have real personalities.
Wow. You started at Atari working on the 2600 games?
Yep.
Is that right? What
yep.
games?
I did just one game. They had a rule. Everybody wanted to work on the home computer. But the rule was you had to do a game for the 2600 before you could do anything for the 800. So I sat down and I learned the 2600 and I built a game for it. And I think I set something of a world record for learning the 2600 and getting a game working on it. I joined Atari in right after Labor Day in 79, and my game was basically ready by the 1st of January. The funny thing was, it was called Wizard. It's out there somewhere on the net. I sent somebody the ROMs years ago, and they read them and put them into a file, and you can play it now. It's a very, very simple game. Because the specification when I started was it had to be 4K. Well, then just as I finished it, we showed it to marketing, and marketing looked at it and said, well, you know, the 8K games now are taking over everything. We can't sell 4K games anymore. So can you redo this for 8K? And I sort of threw up my hands and said, wait a minute. I designed this for 4K. That was a very tight design spec. I came up with something that works very well in 4K. If you want an 8K game, I will throw this away and start all over from scratch. But I'm not going to take this game and just sort of add bytes to it to make it an 8K game. And they said, well, gee, then never mind. Then the guy who was running the 800 software group said, okay, Chris, you did your job. Now come working for me. So I started working on software for the 800.
So what was the first software you did on the 800?
Energy Czar. Actually, I did a bit of a trick there. When you join Atari, very standard, you had to sign a contract saying, well, any ideas you get while working for Atari belong to Atari. But as part of the contract, you can also specify any ideas you've already had. And so I wrote down a long list of games that I had actually built for the Commodore PET. And the first one was Energy Czar. Oh, it was called Energy Crisis at the time. And so I went to Dale Yoakam, who was running that group at that time, and said, you know, I've already got this game designed about the energy crisis. I could redo it and have it up in 4 months for you. But you'll have to pay me $2,000. And they agreed. So I did Energy Czar, and then Scram was the same thing. Eastern Front I did on my own and was the same thing. You know, there were a whole bunch of games. I had about a half a dozen games that I had set aside, and I then proceeded to do a number of them for Atari. Then I was promoted to supervise the Software Development Support Group. I've always been a teacher at heart. There had been a lot of people, I knew a lot of people out in the industry, and a lot of them had been approaching me saying, Chris, could you give us some of the technical specs for the Atari so we could write software for it? And I had said, no, I can't. It's all secret, because the Atari executives had this idiotic notion that we'll make all our money on the software, so we're not going to give out the specifications. And somehow, I think it was Dale, convinced them that this is all wrong, that we want outsiders developing software, we want a big pile of software. They reversed that decision, and the day I got the memo, I started making photocopies of technical documents and mailing them off to people, and I became more and more the contact point. Lots of people were approaching me, and so in December of 80, I think it was, or earlier than that, they asked me to form a group to help people inside and outside program the Atari, to teach them how to do it. So I was the world's first software evangelist, because I went around all over the country with these seminars that were free, where in 2 days we'd teach you everything you needed to know about the Atari. We gave you all sorts of software to help, demos and so forth, and it was a huge success. It really helped bring forth a flood of software for the Atari. This is that whole thing about physics, what is the essence? I was trying to say, you know, what are the real strengths of the Atari? And so I spent a lot of time thinking about its display system, and I zeroed in on this concept of vertical screen architecture as the most important concept to understand in designing a display on the Atari. And that's part of what made the Eastern Front screen so compelling. It really did. It used everything in the Atari. It was really the first game that fully utilized every feature inside that machine.
Alan Kay stole you to work in research.
Yeah.
What happened there?
We were ensconced in the executive building. I was two doors down from Ray Kassar, because that was the only space they could give Alan. And so this was the executive suite, and I and later on one of my employees, we'd be sitting in this room working away at the computer, dressed like programmers. And meanwhile, the open door, there are all these executives dressed in expensive suits walking by and occasionally looking in like, what the hell is this? And to make matters worse, Alan would take us to the executive dining room, which was for executives only, but he could invite us in. And so we'd eat there, and you could see the executive scowling at us like, what are those peons doing in our lunchroom?
So what was the research work? What were you doing?
He basically said, research games, you know, think big. That was the main message, Alan. He kept pushing me hard. Think bigger, you know, think not in terms of where we are and how to improve from that, but think of where we want to be 30 years from now and how to get there. One of his great quotes that I've never forgotten is, if you don't fail, or in fact, I had asked him once, well, you know, we're going to have a lot of problems. We're going to fail sometimes. He said, look, if you don't fail at least 90% of the time, you're not aiming high enough. But he inspired me, and so I thought long and hard about fundamental issues. What's important about games? And that's why I came up with the idea of people, that games should be about people. And then I asked questions, how do we do something with people? And Gossip was the first experiment in that direction, and I was actually rather pleased with it. It was a good little project, although unfortunately I basically threw together the basic concept and all the controlling algorithms, the engine of the game, in a matter of a few weeks. And then the remaining task was to get, you know, some graphics up. And so I hired a summer intern to, you know, put the body around the game. And he got the body up immediately. I mean, it took him a matter of weeks to get all the graphics and sound working. But then, although I'll mention one sound, we had one of my hires at Research was a guy named Randy Smith, who was also a genius, and he put together a sound effect for Gossip. When the phone rang, a character would pick up the phone, put it to his ear, and this was absolutely state-of-the-art, cutting-edge sound technology. He would say, "Hello?" And that was a major step forward. But the summer intern could not get Gossip working, and I wasted months. I should have just fired his ass, but I was too soft. And eventually we transferred him to another division, and I ended up finishing up the thing. But we did Gossip. The major project was Excalibur. That was the big research effort. And we broke all sorts of new ground with Excalibur. It had a lot of stuff in it that was just very different. It represented the only possible intersection between the extremely high ideals that Alan wanted and what was possible with the Atari. I'm proud of that. I think I did a good job with that. It was a good program.
It strikes me that you mentioned that Alan Kay was thinking 30 years into the future, but it seems like, I mean, it definitely the executives, their thinking did not take them anywhere near 30 years in the future.
No, they couldn't think that far ahead. The way they thought was, okay, here's what we got now. Is there any way I can do this a little better? Can I, you know, tweak this dial or, you know, add this little increment there? They had no appreciation of the technology. Now, you got to realize this was 82, 83. The idea of the personal computer was still very young. None of these people actually used them. None of them had a computer on his desk. They didn't play the games. They were just completely out of it. And so they didn't know what the hell they were doing.
So if you could send a message to the Atari community that still exists, and you can right now, what would you tell them?
Have fun. The Atari is a neat machine. The joy of working with it is the same as the joy of fixing up old Volkswagens. It's you know, it's easy to do. It's fun. The 6502 assembler is such a clean, beautiful language. You really can get everything in your head. It's just a delightful machine. And so have fun with it. This is neat stuff. I realize that I have sort of a responsibility now to get rid of all the old Atari stuff I have. Right now I'm working on the free stuff, the source code, you know, getting it all cleaned up, and we're doing it a batch at a time. There's a guy working on Excalibur right now. And basically, we're going to try to get everything out there.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, very good. I hope everybody has lots of fun with the Atari.
We do. Thank you so much, Chris.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Excellent. That was very interesting, Kevin.
Do you remember, he did Energy Czar, and did he do Scram?
Yes.
I didn't know he was the Scram author. That was one of my, I was a nuclear engineer out of college, so that was definitely an interesting game for me.
I don't remember ever playing Scram. I just read about it in the APX catalogs.
That was a favorite game of mine because, you know, on a nuclear submarine, they're always teaching about stuff. And when I took my computer to sea, I showed it off a little bit, and some of the people were really interested in it.
Wait. So you were on your nuclear submarine with your Atari showing off your nuclear power simulation.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Yes, and we did fall into a time warp. No.
thank you for listening to this show. We certainly welcome your feedback. As you heard earlier, we've gotten a lot of feedback, but we always appreciate more. Please also take a minute and rate this show on iTunes. That's really the best way you can help a new podcast that you like. Give it a great rating on iTunes. So please take 2 seconds and give Antic some stars. Also, tell all of your retro computing friends. Also, do you have any memories of the Atari 8-bits you want to share? Maybe you're working on a project involving an Atari computer. Whatever it is, we definitely would like to hear about it. You can contact us via voicemail at 206-426-7200. Please note that is a new number. We had a problem with the last number. We lost it, so we've got a new number, and I feel like this is easier to remember anyway. You can contact us via email at antique@ataripodcast.com or on Twitter at ataripodcast. Our website with show notes and links to all the items we've talked about is at www.ataripodcast.com. Thank you, and see you all later.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, and of course the other one is War Games with the MSI.
I haven't seen that one either.
In that.
You haven't seen War Games?
Oh, wow.
Get off. Log off right now. Go do that.